Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io. And we're back. Another episode of Startup Hustle. Matt DeCourcy here to have another conversation that I'm hoping helps your business grow. Now, for those of you that have listened to Startup Hustle for a while, you know that we often play Mixtape the Game. We build an app for it. And one thing we learned along the way was that we don't know a whole lot about the board game industry. So in order to help figure some of that out, I got a subject matter expert with me today. Now, I'm going to get a little heavy lifting out of the way. Today's episode of Startup Hustle is sponsored by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. And with me today is Dane Chapin. Now, Dane is a super entrepreneur. He also, and we will verify whether this is true or not, may have entrepreneurial ADD. I say that because he does a lot of different stuff on a lot of different days. The great part is he appears to do all of them well, and one of which is as a board game entrepreneur. Now, Dane is the CEO and co-founder of the Made Here brand. He's the co-founder of the Bindle Bottle and the chairman of USopoly. Now, those are all three completely different things that do different stuff, different products, different games, everything. And he's going to tell us all about it. Dane, welcome to Startup Hustle.
Thank you very much. Great to be here, Matt. Thanks for having me.
I'm hoping that you're not salty that I have already accused you of entrepreneurial ADD, but
I think I've had it since I was about 8 years old with my grandmother.
Yeah, I have too.
She accused me of being jack of all trades, master of none.
I've been in the sights on that. Yeah. Yeah. I've been accused of that as well. It's a role that I'm willing to accept. Now, you do a lot of different stuff, and we're going to talk about board game startups primarily, but why don't you start by giving us a little bit of backstory about yourself and go ahead and now look, folks, normally we've got one link in the show notes. We're going to have three of them in there for Dane because, once again, he does a lot of different stuff. But Dane, why don't you give us a background about your different brands, your different things, and then we'll get into talking about how board game startups work.
Sure. When you talk about backstory, I don't know how far back you want to go. I think I had an unquenchable thirst for entrepreneurialism and making money. And since I was probably 8 years old, the number of jobs I held and not necessarily working for others, just generating, essentially my own paycheck, own cash. I had a dark room back before digital photography, almost 50 years ago. I used to take pictures of all the kids in the neighborhood, go around to the parents, show them the proof sheets, and then they would order enlargements from me, again, long before digital photography. And I was actually making some money at 12 years old as a photographer. And, it's just been a relentless drive ever since. I think the last time anybody saw my paycheck, I was 25. Talked to a guy who I'd given tennis lessons to in college to back me on a small real estate apartment development, which I knew nothing about, but managed to talk him into it, and just been doing crazy stuff ever since. Fell into the game board business with my sisters when real estate went to hell in 1994 when we started USAopoly.
So, and let's, you do a couple other things because you're the, either the creator or the co-founder of the Bindle bottle, which, you know, click the link in the show notes, is a water bottle with a stash spot in the bottom for whatever you want. And also I'd like to hear a little bit about the Made Here brand before we get too far into board games.
Sure. Bindle bottle. We started about 3 years ago. There was a kid who grew up near me. I knew his parents really well. He used to, if we'd had a party at our house and we needed a valet to park cars or something, he would eagerly, volunteer, well, not a volunteer, but, eagerly take the job. So he always told me, starting about 16 years old, he wanted to be me when he grew up. So he went to USC undergraduate, studied entrepreneurialism, sent me idea, you know, year after year would send me an idea, got a job out of college, and nothing ever really stuck. One day he sends me this really crude 3D mock-up of a water bottle with storage. So on the bottom, you twist it off, and you can put your keys, you know, your cash, credit card, headset, whatever, you know, so you can go to the gym unencumbered with stuff in your pockets. And started this crazy thing up. It was just, you know, he kept his full-time job. I had my other pursuits. I have a guy that has been working for me and was partnered on some deals who does a lot of the legwork. So we got this thing up and going. We were named on Oprah's favorite things list in 2018, and it really launched the company. Nice. So it's a, you know, we got a patent on it, and it's going gangbusters.
And then what are you guys doing with the Made Here brand?
Well, Made Here launched in September. It's all about celebrating the American worker with goods made in America. So Scott Eastwood, Clint's son, well-known actor. He's got the number one movie in the world in July called The Outpost. I got to get a plug in for the guy.
Yeah.
He's the face of the brand and my partner. You know, in the beginning, we when I introduced him to the idea, he loved it. And he said, you know, Dane, I want to be a piece of this, a part of this thing. And he's not a paid spokesman. You know, he's in the office constantly, you know, working on product. We've launched as an apparel brand, madehearbrand.com. And the goal is to expand into other products that really celebrate the American worker and what America accomplishes. And we've got a show that we've launched called In a Day that lives on YouTube. We spent 24 hours on the USS Nimitz. We got all kinds of shows coming up that just, again, you know, celebrates the American worker at the essence.
I like it. So on the topic of USA, you've got USAopoly, which it appears as if you are licensing and working with, oh man, Monopoly, Clue, Trivial Pursuit, Yahtzee, Risk, Jenga, Scrabble, Operation. And that's one column of five on your website. But, you know, on today's topic, when it comes to board games, I mean, dude, we've all played them, but I don't think anybody really understands, like, how do they end up at my house? And why do I have so many of them?
You know, it's a great question, Matt. There's something about a board game. And, you know, board games are actually our business during COVID. We're up 25% year over year with puzzles and games. You know, games and puzzles offer unique opportunity, particularly games. You know, puzzles is, you know, puzzles can be in a group or solitary, but games give you an opportunity to get around a table with family and friends and, you know, interact and compete and have fun. You know, video games just don't have the same quality. And it's just part of the essence of American life, I think. You know, even as our lives change and, you know, the internet and everything else, I don't think board games are ever going away.
So, and you know, you mentioned it being up during COVID. My wife is an avid puzzler. And for all I know, could be doing a puzzle as we speak right now, but she gets through them quickly. You know, and then there's, I was even watching, Cubers, which was a recent documentary on, Netflix showing the world champion Rubik's Cube solvers. And these guys were solving those cubes in 6 to 8 seconds, which is infinitely faster than I've ever solved one. 'Cause I haven't. But you know, overall, like I said, we're all into this stuff, but how did you get into the board game industry?
You know, I fell into it actually. I mean, like everybody else, I played a lot of games as a kid. I loved Monopoly, but probably no more so than, you know, anybody else. my sisters, to their credit, had this idea to do a twist on Monopoly and to create a theme around it. We went to Hasbro. We got a 2-year license in 1994 to do 5 city editions of Monopoly. They were really doing it more for legal reasons than making money. There's a lot of copyright issues. Monopoly was invented during the Depression in the 30s. And said they wanted to protect their copyrights by extending the game. So I don't know. We managed to talk them into giving us a 2-year license. We launched with San Diego, San Francisco, New York, Atlanta, and Boston. We chose Atlanta, actually, interestingly enough. We wanted to get a toehold there because we knew the Olympics were coming up in 1996. And so we had this dream sort of that we didn't share with them at that point when we got the license, that we'd have the opportunity to do an Atlanta Olympic Monopoly game. And, you know, one thing led to another, and our inflection point actually was the 1996 Olympics. So there's kind of a cool story around that that, you know, I can tell. And that really kind of set the table for us. And we've been in business with Hasbro ever since. So here it is 26 years later, and we've sold millions and millions of Monopoly games with a theme.
So what does that look like? You know, you're sitting there going, okay, I think we want to license or make a game and you want to deal with Hasbro. I mean, do you just call them up and say, hey, we're interested in licensing a game? Like, I mean, what are the mechanics look like on getting to them? I mean, is it similar to like a startup where you have a pitch deck and say, this is what we want to do? Like, I mean, go ahead and speak to me as if I was a 5-year-old child that wanted to play the game.
You know, there's we got a 45-minute limit on the show today, you tell me. So this to tell the entire story would take a day. And probably there's a lot of minutia around it. You know, more than anything, I mean, we just had a relentlessness about it and didn't take no for an answer. You know, got a hold of somebody at a, you know, sort of a low level at Hasbro, and you know, just convinced them to give us a shot at this thing. The worst thing could happen, we'd fail, and you know, they have an obligation to let us do this thing for 2 years, or you know, if they wanted to tell us to jump in a lake because we weren't doing our job. Yeah, we got the license, and we managed to, I think, exceed any expectations they had in terms of, you know, money we could generate. And goodwill toward the game. And so we've been at it for 26 years, so it's been a win-win for them. And they, you know, they're custodians of just, you know, one of the iconic brands in the country. I don't know whether it's a game or anything else. I mean, everybody's knows and has played Monopoly and has got generally fond feelings around it. So we've managed to do a pretty good job to, you know, marry these different worlds from Lucy and Game of Thrones to Elvis to Rolling Stones and Beatles to Simpsons. Keep it really contemporary and topical. And, you know, we had golf Monopoly for years. So, you know, the 50-year-old dad who's an avid golfer, maybe hasn't played Monopoly for a while, you give him a golf Monopoly game, all of a sudden you merge a couple of different worlds, it gets back on the game room table, something. So it keeps the game really fresh and alive. And just the original game is fun too. So it just adds a whole another depth and texture to it.
Yeah, I like to think that those listening to Startup Hustle have a strong affinity for Monopoly. You know, that was the game that I loved to play growing up. I mean, I played a lot of different stuff. Now, you know, we're talking about Hasbro, and I don't think people maybe realize how big Hasbro is. This is a publicly traded company, traded on the NASDAQ, stock price is up. It's a $10 billion market cap company. So like kind of an, I think this is a reasonable question. Like why does Hasbro need guys like you?
You know, I think we fill in the nooks and crannies. You know, they're really, really good at taking a game, turning on the printing presses, getting it into mass markets, selling lots of games of, you know, whether it's Monopoly or Clue. And I think they've identified that, you know, we've got this unique ability to go in and carve up niches where, and we can do it really efficiently, and we pay them a nice royalty, which they're certainly entitled to. So I think it's a win-win for them, you know, financially, and our ability to do it, as I say, super efficiently. And then they're just better at managing, you know, managing us and managing the brand than they would be hiring a team of people internally and then trying to figure out how to go do, you know, a Monopoly game. We've done a lot of corporate Monopoly games. So, you know, we did like a Berkshire Hathaway Monopoly game that sold 20,000 in 2 days at one of their annual stock conventions or stockholders convention in Omaha. So I just think it allows them to extend and leverage what they're doing with people that, you know, have just a different approach to it. And we're out of that, you know, large corporate Leviathan that allows us to do things that they might not be able to do internally. So they get the best of both worlds, really.
So they specialize in the supply chain aspects of it, the production of the game, which is obviously what they're good at. Now, I'm assuming that they want to hang on to that for some, so they have some level of control over the quality and the way the brand is represented. Is that also true?
Oh, absolutely. And I don't think anybody's better than Hasbro at really, you know, having protecting their brands, making sure that, you know, hey, look, we've had opportunities to do some crazy things around Monopoly that just wouldn't really fit the brand. They'd be short-term hits. And it just wouldn't be appropriate for a family game and a family brand. So they, you know, they recognize the need and the to, you know, protect the integrity of the brand long term. So people, you know, continue to revere Monopoly, you know, decades from now.
So one of the most popular subjects on Startup Hustle has to do with capital and the resources that it needs to get any business off the ground and moving. When it comes to board games and a licensing agreement with a company like Hasbro, is that, you know, you mentioned they're using creative outlets like you and others to expand on what they're doing, which is smart because they don't have to take the risk on with that. But when it comes, so when you mentioned like creating a Berkshire Hathaway version, now I'm in Kansas City, the Omaha's right up the street from us. So that's feels somewhat applicable. Is it up to you to, okay, Hasbro, we've got the idea, we want to print 20,000 of these. Is it up to you to buy them and then sell them? Or do they share in that role with you? Like, where does that occur? Because obviously no one wants if you'd only sold 100 of them, someone's stuck with 19,900 of them.
You know, I think the good thing for Hasbro in our case, particularly since we've been a good protector of the brand and we're not looking to, the brand feeds us as well, so we need to protect it and think long term. No, we're a completely independent business. We pay them a royalty. You know, with IP, it's a great place to be. You know, you think of Star Wars. George Lucas made more money licensing out Star Wars than he did selling tickets to the theater. So if you can develop IP, whatever it might be, the value in it for a company like Hasbro or Disney or, you know, the NFL, whoever it might be, these people make, you know, boatloads of money working with guys like me to extend the brand into places that they really, you know, are not expertise in. So it's really a win-win. And, you know, to develop IP in today's world, to me, is, you know, really way up the value chain. And I encourage everybody to try to do it.
So there's obviously a planning and creative process that has to go into launching any iteration of something like Monopoly. What does that look like?
Well, when we started the company 26 years ago, it was my two sisters, a secretary, and me doing everything. So I'd be from writing the copy on the back of the box that's specific to, you know, Pittsburgh Monopoly to selling it into the department store in a particular city. We used to get media on the games. You know, our models changed a little bit from when we originally did city editions of Monopoly. You know, so it's evolved from four people to a team of 68 people. And a lot of those, and, you know, we're third-party logistics, third-party manufacturing. So we really have, you know, a highly, you know, white-collar, very well-trained, passionate workforce. A lot of big chunk of our employee base works in creative development. So we'll have relationships with from HBO and Fox and Disney, working with their teams on game ideas. And then just, you know, with the graphic artists and the project managers, you know, it's a real team effort on both sides. to just protect the integrity of both brands and have it marry on a Monopoly game or a Clue game in a way that provides compelling and interesting play.
So one of the things about any early stage business or business in general, especially if you make a product, is obviously you want to sell as many of them as quickly as you can and clear the inventory. But, you know, long before when people used to sign my paychecks, I worked for the world's largest maker of music, electronic musical instruments. And every now and then you swing and you miss. Do you have a particular story of failure or of something that just didn't go according to plan that you could use as a cautionary tale, or even just something you look back at and you're like, wow, I can't believe we thought that would work?
You know, I actually have two stories. One's a cautionary tale that turned into a win. It was an inflection point of our company. I mentioned it briefly at the front of the show on Olympic Monopoly. So we had pitched Hasbro on the idea a year in advance of the Olympics in Atlanta, and it was the 100th anniversary of the modern Olympics. You know, it was huge. Just, I mean, there was a year-long you know, media fest around the Olympics, and I mean, the Olympians in '96 were, you know, just major stars in the U.S. You know, these games take 9-10 months to develop. There's just a lot of complexity to it. Hasbro calls us up 3 months before the Olympics, says, let's do this. You know, you be careful what you wish for, right? And we said, let's do it. I flew to Atlanta. They jumped on board. So we started literally working 18-hour days getting this game to market. It was, you know, a huge, intense push on our part, trying to put together an Olympic edition of Monopoly. There was just a lot of moving parts, and to do it in a super compressed time, long before, you know, you could send files digitally. You know, we were overnighting on, you know, in the cargo planes, or, you know, United Airlines cargo back to Boston, which is not far from Pawtucket, where Hasbro is located. All the files are printouts. The CEO of Hasbro got involved in the process because he thought this would be a pretty high profile deal, Olympic edition of Monopoly. So we had exposure there, which is pretty exciting for us as this tiny little licensee. Anyway, we get the game done. We're trying to figure out how many to order. We decided to order 35,000 units, which was a, you know, shoot for the stars deal. But we thought, God, Olympics is just so red hot. These things will sell out. We'll have to reorder more. Atlanta organizing committee promised us a huge order. So that was exciting. So we got like 2 weeks before the Olympics, we got orders for 5,000 games. I got 35,000 games in the warehouse. And I'm starting to get a little nervous about how we're going to sell 30,000 other games. I fly to Atlanta a week before the Olympics to do a bunch of press stuff. And, you know, we're up to 6,000 orders, and I got bet the company on all this stuff. So I'm not sleeping, trying to figure out what the hell to do. We got this countdown. I'm in Atlanta 5 days before the Olympics. I decided to ship all the games to a warehouse in Atlanta, just figuring that the thing takes off. We can, you know, have replenishment overnight, you know, so that would help us. I get the woman who was avoiding my calls, who's the buyer for the Olympic committee. She decides she's going to order 90 games. I'm waiting for this order of 20,000 games. I didn't know what the hell I was going to do. You know, just kind of, anyway, keep going to these media interviews, trying to push the game. 2 days before the Olympics, I'm walking to an interview. I got a game under my arm, and somebody says, well, what do you got under your arm? What's that game? I said, it's Olympic Monopoly game. You know, I tell them all about it. They said, well, where can I get one? I said, you know, a local department store. You know, and then I had this idea. I said, well, I'll just give you my game and I'll just go get another one. He said, I don't want your game. You know, I'll go buy one. I told him who I was. And I said, here, I'll tell you what. You can buy it. Just buy this one. I'll sell it to you for wholesale, $20. They said, $20? Done. So it gave me an idea. I rented a van, got a dolly. And over the next 2 weeks, I sold games on the street, you know, with no permit or anything. It was the Wild West. I sold 20,000 games in 2 weeks, got rid of a huge piece of the inventory. And so I turned a situation that, yeah, I didn't know what the hell we were going to do. I still kind of wake up every once in a while thinking, I don't know what I would have done with those games. We could have bankrupted the company. And from that experience, I got a call from the CEO at Hasbro, who didn't know about selling games on the street, but he knew what we did getting the game to market. And we got a 5-year license from Hasbro, and we went from selling city editions to things like Harley Davidson, the NFL, and kind of the rest is history. So turn, you know, disaster into a big win. So you just got to, you know, in terms of, you know, your show, just relentlessness and perseverance to just find alternative ways, you know, maybe non-traditional ways to make things work. Although sometimes you
Did you sell all of them? Did you sell all 35,000?
We ended up selling all 35,000. I think by the end of the Olympics, we had 5,000 left, and there was some rub off after the Olympics. And so it we managed to turn a near death experience into a win. And then I think the other experience that, you know, we were going into these different niches, and we did a Lionel Trains edition, I don't know, 20 years ago. And, you know, where there, at the time, you know, you do your research, oh, there's 20 million people that collect trains and have train sets. And so we printed a huge number of train Monopoly games. Well, it turns out all those numbers were really exaggerated. So rather than dipping our toe in, you know, printing 5,000 games and maybe running a little short, making it hot and having interest because you're out of inventory, we probably still have Lionel Train Monopoly games in inventory. So, you know, you really need to know your market and what people want. And, you know, and there we just made assumptions based on, you know, really kind of bad information or not complete information.
How have you gotten better at that over the years? Because, you know, you mentioned I'm well attuned to this. I think a lot of people aren't. So many people, when they think about startups these days, they think about tech and different stuff. Now, in my book, Million Dollar Bedroom, I talk about anytime you want to start a business, you need to understand your path to revenue. If you have a services business, your path to revenue can be really short because you can perform services for people the day the company opens. Now, with a business like yours, you have to create and manufacture a product that's a little slower. With something like software, it could take years, or you might not ever even generate revenue. But, like you mentioned, you can sink the ship. Well, let's use it. You can sink the battleship pretty the quickly. Game. Yeah, that's right. I'm thinking ahead. I'm smart here. But you know, overall, like how is your planning and approach to this stuff changed? Because I feel like it's got to be a lot easier to do that now than it might have been 25 years ago.
God, I'll tell you, it's still science and art. I mean, I just don't think there's any perfect way to do it. I mean, I just do know that you've got to. You know, every day the business landscape changes, and it's not necessarily because COVID, you know, jumps in. I mean, COVID's kind of interesting in terms of, you know, all of a sudden it changed people's consuming habits. Hey, look, thank God I'm not a restaurant with strictly indoor seating. You know, those are closed in California right now, and with, you know, no way to pivot on that. Now, I know guys with restaurants that are doing takeout business and pivoting and trying to do everything in their, you know, power to stay in business until, you know, the lockdown ends. From our point of view, you know, we were selling crazy amounts of puzzles, a lot of stuff through Amazon. They're running out of inventory. So they had a moratorium for 6-8 weeks on bringing in any non-necessities into their warehouses. So here we had a great business opportunity to sell lots of games and puzzles, and we couldn't replenish inventories. And then they started opening those ability to send in games. And then we've had on and off issues with our suppliers. You know, we do some stuff over in the Far East. We also domestically manufacture a lot of stuff, and there's been intermittent delays. So just every day you got to wake up and, you know, just be really realistic. There's just no long-term guaranteed annuities on anything, I'm learning. Yeah, I have a current experience with Made Here. We've got this show in a day. Scott's the host. They're 12-minute videos. We launched our pilot 3 months ago, where we spent 24 hours on the USS Nimitz. And we're using it as sort of a way to promote the brand. It's Made Here Presents in a Day, and in a day is to celebrate the American worker. Well, this show, it's a really cool show. I got a lot of great feedback. It's, you know, bite-sized, easy to watch. We got 500,000 views with no promotion on it. 6-8 weeks later, we launched, we spent a day with the Blue Angels and launched that show, you know, 3 or 4 weeks ago, thinking it'll just piggyback on it. And it's performing at like 1/10 or 1/20 the pace of the Nimitz. And I have no idea in hell why it's just as compelling of a show. So you wake up in the morning, you try to figure it out. I mean, we've been doing some promotion on TikTok, and that, you know, TikTok's a whole different, you know, turning into a can of worms. But I think they actually, TikTok games the system, like the third thing we posted around Bindle Bottle, got a million views. It really kind of made no sense because it was nothing really super special about it. It was cute. And nothing is remotely approached it since then. And I tend to think, based on stuff that we've read online and experience we've heard, you know, TikTok game the system where they get your attention by, you know, they can run, you know, a dog going for a walk and turn it into a million views if they want. So I think you just have to understand when you're being manipulated too. And really, you know, this stuff, it's complicated. And there's it's not linear. There's no rhyme or reason to it. You just got to go in and try to figure out the math every day or the calculus.
So you mentioned Amazon, and I think that brings up a good point because, you know, Amazon's changed the landscape of retail e-commerce. I think the last time I looked, it was 53% of all e-commerce. And, you know, for those of you listening, we do have a weekly show with Andrew Morgans, who is Startup Hustle's Amazon brand acceleration expert and e-commerce guy, as we'll say. And, you know, that I mean, we literally brought Andrew in to host shows because it's Amazon has become such an important part of so many people's businesses. That said, they take a fair amount of the sale, but they also do a fair amount of stuff, meaning people that sell products, they can send it to Amazon and they act as a fulfillment center and do a lot of other stuff. How has Amazon changed the board game industry as a whole, and maybe even specifically your interaction or your involvement in the industry?
You know, good question. I mean, obviously, Amazon's a juggernaut, and you've got to make them part of your strategy, whether you're in the board game business or, you know, widgets or shoes or whatever it might be. You know, we're, you know, and everybody's, you know, a lot of different people have different perspective on Amazon, you know, and there's a, you know, a lot of people support it. A lot of people have issues with it. A lot of people had issues with Walmart. I mean, it's, you know, it's a constantly changing landscape. Right. Yeah. And, you know, I think back to, you know, I don't want to get political, but you talk about, hey, there's this discussion around crony capitalism. You know, it's just in the year 2000, GE was worth $600 billion, the king of the world, you know, corporate titan, huge army of lobbyists in Washington. You know, they could get their way, right? They had huge government contracts along with everything else. Apple was worth $5 billion on life support. So, you know, if a crony capitalism is alive and well, you know, why 20 years later is GE on life support worth $50 billion and Apple's approaching $2 trillion in value? So, you know, Amazon's going to have to stay on their toes. Somebody's going to figure out to develop a better mousetrap. It looks inconceivable that Amazon's not going to be, you know, own the world and be on top for the rest of time. And when you're in the middle of it, it's kind of, you know, it's hard to see, you know, it's hard to see that Walmart's playing catch up. If you think where they were 20 years ago, you know, Amazon, everybody was thought it was convinced, other than people that bought the stock, and there's way too many people that sold the stock too early, that they were convinced that Amazon wasn't going to be able to, you know, survive. And they've been relentless and pursued it. I'll tell you, interesting reading is Jeff Bezos' original shareholder letter from 1990-something, or 99, whenever it was. It's a phenomenal letter, and they've stayed true to this, to their strategy and just underlying fundamentals and foundation from the beginning, and it's obviously served them well, and they've pivoted time and time again.
You know, I talk to a lot of people about a lot of different things, and the thing that drives me nuts is people, okay, you have these folks that, oh, I don't need a website. First off, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard, if you're telling me that in 2020, because you don't look like you're even in business at that point. And then it's people that make a product and don't want to sell it on Amazon. Now, look, here's the thing is like, and if you're not on Amazon, I think people will look at you and say, like, you're not even, well, gosh, you're not even there. And, you know, there's so much to that. It's the same thing with Walmart. And I thought that was actually a really great example, Dane. I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, I'm 45 years old at this point, and 25 years ago, Walmart was the one that was quote, putting people out of business. And a long time ago, I lived in Durango, Colorado. One of the five colleges that I dropped out of was Fort Lewis College. And it was a big deal when Walmart moved into town. And the people in Durango had fought it for 6 or 7 years. And finally it happened. And literally, as it was opening, some businesses just said, man, fuck it, I'm quitting now. Others tried to hang in there. And there was a little bit of Darwinism that occurred there. So, you know, that same thing's going on with Amazon in a lot of cases. I mean, look, the mall just isn't the same. Overall, on some level, you got to be where the eyes of the buyer exist. So you got to figure some of that out. Now, with me once again, I've got Dane Chapin. Dane is the CEO and co-founder of a lot of stuff, man. The Made Here brand, the Bendel Bottle, USAopoly, which does a lot of really fun and interesting games. Now, speaking of fun and interesting in my world, today's episode of Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io. We help you build a software team quickly and affordably. Now, I want to ask for some advice. So, Fullscale.
I'll get my psychiatrist on the phone.
Oh, man. Well, you know what's funny, Dane? We started this podcast, and I often have my business partner, the other Matt Watson, with me. We started the Startup Hustle because we had a strong desire to complain about being entrepreneurs. We felt that we just needed a safe place to have tears and beers on some days. But so, you know, along the timeline, Fullscale's chief marketing officer is a guy named Joel Johnson, and Joel is the creator of Mixtape the Game. And we've learned a lot about this industry along the way, largely that it's hard to break into. And that there's a lot of competition. So, you know, Mixtape's a game. Well, here, let me pull a card out of the Mixtape deck. It's difficult to play with two people. So with Mixtape, we pull a card and we have to name a song that would come to mind. Now, typically we want to have three people. So here we go. This is geographically specific for you. So if I pulled a card out of the Mixtape deck and I said, what's the best song for riding a beach cruiser down Venice Beach Boardwalk? We would both pick a song, and theoretically, we would perpetually tie with two players, but if we have three, we'd vote for who the winner was. What song would you pick to be playing while you rode a beach cruiser down Venice Beach Boardwalk?
God, this is like my worst nightmare. Songs. I have no memory. You know, I'm just going to go to something. Let It Be.
There you go. There you go. I don't know if I want to know why I feel like that was the first song that came to mind, which I tell people is the answer. I'm going with Today Is a Good Day by Ice Cube.
You win. Now, you win.
There you go.
There
you go.
An answer. You were going to win.
So that's fine. But so with that, you know, one of the things that Joel learned early, now he sold over 100,000 of these decks before we partnered with him to build a app.
Well, which you should
learn a lot.
You need to license the game to USA. You need to license the game to USAopoly. We'll sell a million of them.
Well, we're ready to make a deal, because here's the thing. We did actually already license it to a board game manufacturer, which we're coming up on the end of that. Now, one of the things that Joel learned we're going to call him a solopreneur at the time. So Joel was working at Husqvarna. He had a quote, real job. He works at Fullscale now. But he had to, you know, he was trying to find someone to support, invest, or get behind his dream. Now, here in Kansas City, at Fullscale, we host, we have a suite at our local concert venue, and we host these events that we call Sweet and Greet, and we invite local entrepreneurs, investors, and influencers to come. And Joel came one night, and I'd never met him, and he had Mixtape with him. And I worked in the music industry, I mentioned, in a couple different verticals for almost 15 years. He explained the game to me, and I said, dude, that needs an app. And he looked right at me and says, well, now you know why I'm here. 9 days later, we had bought 35% of the company, and we got to work on this stuff. But one thing that I realized for Joel that was very difficult was, because that type of product or business is not what, I'm going to use air quotes here, normal, and that investors don't understand how that works. He had a very difficult time trying to find someone to get behind what he was doing. So is the best way to do that to call someone like you that already has experience and work on a licensing deal? Is it to try to go at it alone? Like, what for someone that has a unique concept or game, like, how do you get someone to get behind you or to get it moving?
I'll tell you, that's the essence of business, really. I mean, it's, we all want this, you know, magic bullet that we got this great game. We got 10 friends that tell us, you know, maybe what we don't, you know, they don't have the courage to tell you what you don't want to hear. So they tell you, you got a great game. You know, maybe you do have a great game. It's just a lot of missionary work. Whether you're a USAopoly or a Hasbro, I mean, you better have a goddamn good game that people like to play, that's easy to, you know, the rules are not too difficult, but difficult enough so it's not inane. It's got to be compelling. And then, you know, let's assume you have a great game. It just starts there. There's thousands of new games in the marketplace every year. You know, who doesn't have a game idea? You know, we have lots of advantages, the ability to, you know, work with, you know, a Barnes & Noble or an Amazon or whoever, you know, to get distribution. But you got to get the word out. And I'll tell you what drives me nuts in my office every day is, you know, I don't want to be too cliche around millennials, but I don't, you know, I don't hear people on the phone. I'm on the phone all day long, all day long, you know, emails, I'm doing emails while I'm on the phone. And it's, you know, it's crickets, a lot of it, you know, just quiet. And I go nuts when people aren't on the phone working it. And it's just, when people can't forget, yeah, I don't care if there's computers. I got a couple quick stories, but you know, computers and you know, text messaging and everything else. You want to hear a human voice, you know, you got to get on the phone and the nuance of the human voice and talking to somebody, responding in real time to maybe something, being likable. And, you know, with Bindle, you know, we got closed down for a while, but I insist to go to, you know, street fairs, touch people, show them the item. We're not going to just succeed by having, you know, on being on social media and having some clever little thing that goes viral. You got to touch people up close and personal every day, whether it's on the phone, in person. I don't care what your business is, probably even more so, you know, you got to build people one at a time. And then one turns into two, turns into four, turns into eight. You develop missionaries. So there's just no shortcut, whether you're a USAopoly or a, you know, one person, one woman business in a garage with a good game idea. You've just got to do the missionary work. No replacement for it. And then, you know, along with that, I tell, you know, my daughter and her friends and, you know, anybody, there's never been more opportunity in the history of the world. You can project, you know, further, farther, better because of these tools with less capital and start a business. Everything is commoditized, you know, so you can, logistics are commoditized, manufacturing commoditized, so you don't have to build your own factory. So there's just lots of advantages, you know, that people didn't have years ago, but there's a flip side to it too.
The thing that really blew my mind as the investor in that part of the story was, here we had a remarkably likable guy. It's a super fun game to play. I felt that selling the number of units that they had sold, and, you know, half of those were in a 50K order to Target. I couldn't understand why no one was sitting down to talk to him. I mean, he really was having a difficult time getting in front of investors. Now, I mean, I do know why. I mean, the why behind that is that investors typically don't like to get behind things that they don't understand. And I mean, that has a lot to do with it. And, you know, the whole thing is, and then also I think investors are just kind of like, oh, they flock to whatever's hot. You know, if you in January, no one would have told you that EdTech was the place to invest. Now you talk to those same people and they're like, I love educational technology. It's a pillar of our investment strategy. You know, and 6 months ago, they wouldn't have touched it with someone else's money. But yeah, so I was really surprised with that. It's a journey that we're still figuring out, the digital version of stuff. And this is the last question I have for you. You know, how is the digital nature of games? Because I can, you know, okay, I remember playing Monopoly on like the PlayStation at one point, and I'm not a gamer in that regard, but how has the digital nature of games affected the physical product of games?
Oh, I don't know how to answer that question. But the digital nature of a game, it still doesn't lend itself to playing around a table with a group of people. And, you know, it doesn't have the tactile, you're not touching, holding things, flipping cards, flipping at people. So I just think there's a unique nature to a board game, if it's a good board game, that it's irreplaceable. So there'll be a place for digital, you know, where a kid will hole up in his room for hours on end playing it in a solo nature. But, you know, hey, we're social beings, and people want to be together around a table sharing laughs. So I just think a board game provides an irreplaceable outlet for that. Hopefully.
Yeah, one thing the digital version of mixtape is able to do that the cards can't is actually play the songs. So that does change the dynamic a little bit. But yeah, there's definitely still a strong desire to have a physical anything. So I would love it if people could see the video feed, because I think Dane has dropped his laptop somewhere. there he is, but that's okay. And once again, I want to thank you for your time. This has been really interesting. I've often wondered what the mechanics were behind the board games and how those end up. Today's episode of Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io. We help you build software teams quickly and affordably. Dane, we wrap up episodes of Startup Hustle with what we call the founder's freestyle. You've done a lot of different things. What's your core, if you just had to give some simple advice to any founder, what would that be?
Just work harder than the next guy. Have people that are in your life that you respect their opinion, that have the courage to tell you what you don't want to hear. Just don't sit behind a computer. I mean, you got to get out and touch people, show people your thing, listen intimately. Your customer is your best friend. You just have to position yourself to listen to them and get feedback. You know, we launched a couple of colors on Bindle that aren't working. These camo, I just thought that things were going to hit it out of the park. We're stuck with a bunch of extra inventory. I think if we queried our customers and got feedback before we launched these colors, we may never have launched them. So you just can't live in a vacuum. You've just got to be constantly informing yourself, reading as much as possible, touching as many people as possible in person, on the phone. I can't emphasize that strong enough.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you said multiple times during this episode, and this is where I'll leave my freestyle at, is, you know, perseverance. You got to work hard. It's staring at the face of a 30,000 mountain, a 30,000 unit mountain of Olympic Monopoly games. You got on a plane, got a van, and turned yourself into a street vendor. And, you know, the thing is everybody I know that's successful, they got a story like that, Dane. I mean, they do. It's like at some point they're like, you know what? Like, I'm not letting everything control me. I'm going to control the situation. I love the taking it back to the streets approach of pick up a phone, you know, let people in front of you. If you are likable or you have energy, like after people meet me, they're like, man, you have a lot of energy. I'm like, thanks. But the problem is that's sometimes hard to spread or let other people feel without them being around you. And, you know, while we're in the middle of a pandemic that no one asked for, it will end. And we're going to have to get back out there, get in front of other people, show people what you got. You know, everyone had a plan until they got punched in the face. We love quoting Mike Tyson.
I love here. That it's quote. True. I love it.
No, because it's so true. Like never once in the history of plans have the plan actually gone exactly as it was laid out by a startup founder in early stage business. So Dane, this has been awesome. I'm going to send you a deck for mixtape and I'm going to give you some time to prepare your answers for every card while we let our existing licensing agreement run out so we can get into your fold down the road.
I love it.
Yep. So thanks for your time. And man, I'm going to get to work. I'll see you next time.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time.